at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation.
Goodbye, everybody.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program regarding science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, tomorrow is Ray Bradbury's 90th birthday. So happy birthday, Ray. We're going to be talking about that some more. Stay tuned. the music of Peter Schickele from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running. Two cuts of music. The Space Fleet, followed by Saturn, and the Space Fleet serving as the intro music for this program since it began in 1972. So, we are here for two purposes. This is an abbreviated version of the show. Originally, we were only scheduled to be on from 5 to 6 because of fundraising activities. But rather than put on a tape, I spoke to the program director, Tony Bates, and he said, well, if it's Ray Bradbury's birthday, you can, you know, do your regular show. But then Simon Lokely, whose show is also truncated, has a very specific agenda, you know, something that he needs to do. I mean, literature, you know, takes its time. I've forgotten exactly what he has. So he will come in. He will join me at about 6:30 and we'll take on from there so that he has enough time. But all this month on my show and on the Golden Age of Radio and Mass Backwards, we have all been enjoying and acknowledging the audio and radio work of Ray Bradbury. And this morning we're going to share another Pacifica interview with you. We played my interview with Bradbury from just a wee bit under 10 years ago, 9.5 years ago, when he got the National Book Award for Fahrenheit 451. And we played that last week. This week we are going to play an interview with Mike Hodel. Mike Hodel's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. Worked here at WBAI as a news director. In fact, when this show began, when Margot Adler was the the creator of this program, when this show began, I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays. This show was Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. And Hodel had worked with Baird Searles. I was Baird Searles' intern. And Hodel worked on a radio series called Of Unicorns and Universes. Neil Conan also had some input into that show. He's now, I don't know, Uber producer at NPR. He's in charge of a whole lot of stuff there. Hodel left WBAI to become the news director at our sister station at KPFK, where he then began, since we had, since Baird had started him off doing science fiction reviews and stuff like that, and he did a couple of productions, readings here at WBAI, he got himself a time slot there, and he called it Hour 25. And a fine show. Mike was a great reader and a wonderful interviewer. And like Margot Adler, a news person who had interest in spec fic, he got himself an additional slot. It was Friday nights, I think, from 11:30 till midnight. So here we have Hour of the Wolf, which is 2 hours long. And there we had Hour 25, which is half an hour long. And at one point, Mike just up and died. I'm not even sure of what. It was sort of like with Terry Carr, one of the great editors and neat people in the science fiction world. Somebody put it as he just had a body that wasn't made to be long-lasting. And it was absolutely, utterly tragic. It's tragic at any age, but, you know, he was young. And however, he has left a body of work behind him. And one of the things that he left was another interview with Ray Bradbury, another Pacifica interview with Ray Bradbury. And, you know, no doubt with Bradbury's birthday being tomorrow, 90 years old, it's going to get a certain amount of coverage. And, oh, yes, we must talk about a viral YouTube video. You know, you're going to, hopefully, I'm hopeful that you're going to be hearing things. And there's a new biography about Heinlein. Why on Bradbury's 90th birthday is everybody talking about Heinlein is beyond me. You know, Bradbury's with us. So at any rate, I was surfing the web about Tuesday, and I saw, I was just Googling up the name Ray Bradbury, and I saw something listed as me, Ray Bradbury, and the isn't the is one of the, it's the first of the infamous seven words. Now, normally, I ought to be able to tell you the name of this because, you know, until 6 a.m., we're in what has been described by lawyers in the Supreme Court as safe harbor. But Pacifica has not yet released us, even though the indecency rules are passed. I still have to say, even though this is the title of a song and video. I recommend you all, and if you're awake at this hour, I presume that you are mature and not young people who normally are not awake at this hour, unless you're on Habte Selassie's show and you're his grandkids. And Habte, I have business with your daughter and grandkids. I think they should be doing reviews for my show, books and movies. I'm serious. I mean, there's no reason why not. We don't have enough young voices here. So I'm very serious about that, really.
I'll talk to you.
Yeah, they can send me, you know, recordings through North Carolina. We can use FTP and all that, but this is doable. I'll
talk to you.
Yeah, I'm not just saying that. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good
thank you. So, where was I? Yes, so you go to YouTube, and you type in the F word, me, Ray Bradbury. And watch the ensuing video. It is clever, it is funny, it is witty. It's from a woman named Rachel Bloom of the Upright Citizens Brigade. And it is jaw-dropping. That's when I saw it, I came across it, and it said it had been posted like 2 hours earlier. And then I saw somebody else who's following my Twitter feed. I saw that they had somebody who had posted it. I tweeted it, and sure enough, about five people retweeted what I did. And that was a bare beginning, and I don't know that I caught it. I didn't. I got it from somebody else. But this is what you call going viral. This is a viral video, meaning that one person tells 10 people and each one of them tell 10 people. And by now she's had like, you know, I don't know, 500,000 page views, something like that. And it's only been up for about 5 days now. And you take a look at this thing, and with a title like that, and believe me, this thing is not, it's R-rated. You may have to turn off your mature waivers or something like that in order to read it just because of the name. And there's no nudity, sexiness, but no nudity. And it's me, Ray Bradbury, and it is clever, it is funny, it is brilliant. And I have little doubt that we have not heard the end of the career of Rachel Bloom, and watch her stand up bit as well, her other thing on YouTube, and well, you'll see. But I wonder who paid for this. I mean, that thing is produced very well. It looks good. Somebody, there's special effects and everything. It's good. You know, this is a proper video. That's why I was wondering, you know, with all of that stuff in it, somebody had to foot the bill. I'm just curious. At any rate, I don't know how Ray will feel about that at age 90. It is probably not exactly something that Heinlein would have loved it, you know, but Ray, I'm not so sure about. I met Heinlein very briefly. I did like a 10-minute interview with Heinlein, but I've met Ray on two occasions and, you know, spent time talking with him. So, why don't we listen to Mike Hodel talking with Ray for a bit, and then we will talk about WBAI. The point being, yes, this is the point I was going to make earlier. In major media, yes, you will see on YouTube, you can see a lot of, you know, college campus interviews with Bradbury giving a speech here. There's, of course, the time I mentioned that he was here for the National Book Foundation. The Walt Whitman Society gave Bradbury a Medal of Honor this year. I actually helped get them in touch with Ray. And so on and so forth. There's a lot of stuff out there. But for detailed interviews going, oh, my God, one of the great resources of all time, the two places that have really paid attention are KPFK and WBAI. And I'll point out that, you know, Mike Hodel was here first. He's one of us. You can claim him out there. Before he died, you know, Mike Hodel's Hour 25, which still, by the way, exists as, I think it's a monthly show on the internet, Hour 25. But, oh, for God's sake, I didn't silence my Murph. There, it just said Murph again. I got Froyo on it, though. It upgraded itself. So
frozen,
it's
yogurt?
Yeah, that's what it stands for, yes. Mm. It was Cupcake, now it's Froyo. They have code names for the different versions.
Froyo from the Lord of the Rings?
Yes, that's exactly it. Froyo Baggins. It's an all-new operating system. It makes it much faster. I have to say that the last version, Cupcake, really slowed this phone down drastically. Uh-huh. From I got it when it was 2.0, when the Murph the Murph first came out from Verity Systems, the Verity phone service. And it was quite fast. And then the last version, Cupcake, added a lot more things, but it ran slow. Mm. I haven't seen too many reviewers say that. Now it has Froyo, Android 2.2. And I've got to say, it does new things now. It is way cool.
But why is it talking to you? That's one of the way cool things it does.
I got an email.
I see.
It was informing me that I had a new email, and it's probably a reminder or, it's a cookbook offer.
So do I understand you're about to launch into this Hodel thing?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I just wanted, we have to give major props to Jerry Hendiges. From whose show this was taken.
I don't know him.
He was one of the founders of SPURDVAC, the Society to Preserve and Encourage Radio Drama, Variety, and Comedy, ooh, which is one of the major old-time radio fan clubs, shall we say, in the country.
Yeah.
It's based in California and in L.A., and he's, you know, a major collector, a major source for me and for Radio Spirits and, you know, all you know, people that want good quality stuff. And
I see his name is on this interview, which is, by the way, from October 1976.
Yes. It was more specific, but I think it was the 13th. But at any rate.
Good enough. But so he was in there with Mike. He was on the
show. Yeah, well, I think he explains it here. He grabbed Hodel because he knew more about the subject. And that, I'm not.
Really? I mean, Hodel was no slouch. He knew his
that's
stuff.
That's what I mean. He has Hodel come in with him to do the interview.
Oh, this isn't an Hour 25.
No. This is, I think he said this appeared on NPR. Why? I don't know. Because I guess he had a show on NPR at the time.
Maybe it was KCRW.
Well, Hendiges had the show, and he brought Hodel to help with the interview.
Okay.
So that's why they're all together, and it has something to do with collaboration with Norman Corwin and Bradbury. But it expands into, okay, you know, as every Bradbury interview does, it expands in all directions. But
okay, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a radio-related thing.
Okay, and let me see how long this is, because 35 minutes, yeah, because we have an abbreviated show. I'm only on until 6:30.
Oh, well, yeah, you may not want to play at all, but it's a good taste of...
Yes, and that's the point. We're giving you a taste. The first taste is free. The second taste, the whole thing, you want the whole thing, $60.
Yes.
But if you order right now, you will get not only this interview, Jerry Hendigas, is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Okay. With
Jerry. I'm not even sure if I spelled it right there. It's an interesting name.
But phonetically, we're taking it as Hendigas.
Yes.
And the wonderful, our own Mike Hodel.
Right.
And not only that, but also my interview with Ray Bradbury, which Matthew Finch came in on as well, and about 20 hours of radio drama.
Yes, and 2 hours that have been added are this 2-hour show from Jerry, of which this is just the Bradbury interview. There's a short interview with the two guys who produced, they went on to produce Bradbury 13.
Ah, okay.
But this is like 10 years earlier, and they have produced an hour-long version of The Illustrated Man in binaural or surround sound.
I remember when that was done, yeah.
And I don't know where it was heard. I didn't even know it existed until I heard this show a week ago.
Yeah,
So that hour of binaural stereo, it's The Fox in the Forest and Kaleidoscope.
Yeah, binaural is more or less the audio equivalent of 3D.
Yeah, yeah. So that's part of the package as well,
so
along with the two interviews.
So as I say, the first taste is free, and we're going to hear about 15 minutes of it. And but you want the whole thing. You want to celebrate Bradbury's 90th birthday. You want to celebrate the radio station that brings you this kind of stuff on Golden Age of Radio, on Mass Backwards, and Hour of the Wolf.
Yes.
Then you subscribe to WBAI, you give a gift of $60, and we give you a gift that Max has been working on for about a month now.
Yes, to the exclusion of many things.
Yeah,
sleeping, eating,
and just so that, and you know, it's not like, well, actually, Max doesn't get paid for this. You get paid for doing your ops work. You're not paid for your programming.
Heavens, no.
So this is for all of us a labor of love.
Oh, absolutely.
And
for another taste, by the way, on Sunday night, on Bradbury's actual birthday, the Golden Age, I will be covering a horror show, The Screaming Woman, with Margaret O'Brien and Agnes Moorehead.
Yes.
Which was done on Thanksgiving Day in 1948.
I didn't realize it was Margaret O'Brien. Okay, I knew it was Moorhead, yeah.
And we have the Dimension X version of Kaleidoscope.
Right.
Which is very different than the suspense version of Kaleidoscope that has William Conrad in it. However, I'm going with the Dimension X. I don't know why, because we're hearing suspense with...
Yeah, but we have to get the Steve Erickson version that was done at WBAI.
Well, if we get it, it can go on.
Yeah.
If we have Steve's blessing. And finally, what are we going to hear? Oh, to get to the heartwarming. It's science fiction, but it's more heartwarming human stuff. The Rocket. And to say any more about that story would give it away. So,
yeah, and that is
from classic. NBC Short Story.
That is there are so many things that are classic Bradbury that have his flavor, his style.
Well, that's why we selected these three.
And so many science fiction writers fare very badly in the movies, and certainly the last production of A Sound of Thunder wasn't the best thing ever done. But Bradbury has done fairly well with the TV version of I Sing the Body Electric. That was not bad at all.
That was Twilight Zone?
They
did it on the Twilight Zone. Electric Grandma, yes?
Yes.
So to speak.
No, but there was also, I think, a production on the new... Not the newer, but the new Twilight Zone, the one that was done by Harlan Ellison and George R. R. Martin. With Phil, what's his name, Phil DeGard or something like that. There was one producer who did a lot of good science fiction and fantasy television, some interest in bizarre stuff. Like, he did The Spirit on ABC. He did a whole bunch of bizarre shows, and he really got the stuff. He was very good, the Ronald D. Moore of his day.
Yeah.
But Bradbury had finally somebody made the movie Something Wicked This Way Comes, and please, I'm sorry, that video has me misspelling Something Wicked This Way Comes. And when I say come, I mean a book. Anyway, that video is viral. It really is viral. And when the...
You caught something from it, eh?
Yes, I think so. It's unprotected video. And you see, it threw me off.
Something wicked this way.
It was written as a screenplay. People think that it is a book by Bradbury. It is. He wrote the screenplay first, and he tried to sell that screenplay and was unsuccessful, so he wrote a novel. Then years later, somebody said, hey, what an interesting novel. We should make a movie from it. And Bradbury got out his screenplay. And he has done screenplays of The Halloween Tree. Moby Dick, which was directed by John Huston, is written by Ray Bradbury, folks. And but on Bradbury's fiction as well, we have one of the really well-done movies in science fiction of all time, Fahrenheit 451, directed by Francois Truffaut, starring Oscar Werner and Julie Christie.
And he was so inspired by Moby Dick that he came up with something called Leviathan 99.
Oh, my God, yes. yes.
Which was originally a radio script.
Really? Brad.
Which, if you're very lucky, I can say no more on the subject.
But Bradbury's obsessed with Moby Dick. He really is and always has been. He wrote an epic poem version of Moby Dick that we have in the Pacifica Archives. Are you aware of this? I'll see if I can get a hold of that. We had it once. I haven't heard it in 20 years.
Was it on the list?
I don't think so.
What's in there? What a shame.
It's about 2.5 to 3 hours long, Max. I'm not sure. But we have a speech of Bradbury talking about it. Because Bradbury is one of the great American writers, and he felt a kinship to Melville, very American feel. In the sense of what's good about American writing. And he got that. So please remember all this and all these wonderful things that we are offering, because $60 as a gift to WBAI, and what Max is doing, he could bill out easily at $75 an hour. But what would you say?
Is that the going rate these days? Boy, am I being like swindled.
You could.
No wonder I can't afford teeth.
Exactly. What would you say? You've put about 50 hours into this so far of your work?
Could be.
Yeah.
And now I have to get around to actually compressing everything. Right. I'm collecting it all in high-quality format. Now we have to actually make the MP3s. Yeah, we got to make it fit.
Yeah,
we gotta
exactly.
Jam it in there.
So $60, 212-209-2950. And you can, I don't want to say order this, because the idea is you're not ordering a purchase.
It's our gift to you for your support.
You give a gift to us, we give a gift to you. That is how it works.
And it comes without all the palaver surrounding the pitching of the premium.
Exactly.
You just get the goods. You just get the Bradbury.
You get the goods Bradbury, and that's it. So please make that pledge. Please help us out. But let us also now celebrate Ray Bradbury's birthday by listening to a little of this material. And we're only on for another hour after this. And it would be nice if we raised money now, I could play a whole radio drama. How long is the one you had in mind?
It's a half hour.
Yeah.
I have plan B that might work.
Yeah.
Well, they did a...
Plan B from outer space?
They did a Dimension X called The Martian Chronicles, and it's basically like 5-minute snippets from little stories.
Oh, we could do some
of those. We could take, a little stories out of it.
Yeah, but for his birthday, I'd like to play a whole thing.
Oh, okay.
His birthday is tomorrow.
All right. Well, if the one I selected, I think, is my favorite of all.
Yeah. So I'd like to play that. And in order to be able to do that, we need to raise some money. So give a call. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. $60 pledge to listener-sponsored radio will give you this gift of two CDs of Ray Bradbury MP3s.
Yes. And even if we relent and go to the interview very shortly, you can call while it's playing.
Absolutely.
Because you're going to get the whole thing. We're not going to hear it all now. You're going to get the whole thing as part of the package.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't intend to continue pitching now. The idea is I'm going to start playing it. And while it's playing, I'd like to see a couple of calls coming in. So let's do that. Then we're going to pitch a little more. And then hopefully we'll be able to hear that radio drama. So give a call now, 212-209-2950. And thank you, Jerry Hendiges. And thank you, of course, the late and wonderful Mike Hodel. And thank you, and happy birthday, Ray.
And so without further ado, let's go back to October of 1976 and join Mike Hodel and myself as we interviewed Mr. Ray Bradbury. Mr. Bradbury, it's indeed an honor and my special pleasure to welcome you to our show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Also with us today, I have infringed a bit upon a friendship to ask Mike Hodel to come down and help me out again. Mike, the holder of the coveted Golden Mike Award, is Special Projects Director of KPFK and hosts his own science fiction program, Hour 25, along with his wife Terry, Mitchell Harding, and Kathy Culkin. Mike, welcome once again to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Mike, of course, is going to help me in the interview because he is much more knowledgeable in this than I am. And so really happy to have everybody down here. And I'm a bit in awe of both of you gentlemen. Mr. Bradbury, I would like to start out asking you about your current endeavors with Mr. Norman Corwin.
Well, I after waiting for 37 years or so, at long last, we hope this winter to get started on our own radio series. I fell in love with the work of Norman Corwin when I was 19 years old. I remember tuning in a CBS Columbia Workshop program on a Sunday in 1939 without knowing what I was listening to. And I heard a half-hour experiment in sound, sending sound around the world, trying all kinds of experiments with sound and vibrations and what have you. And when the program was over, I listened for the name, and the name was Norman Corwin. Well, it was instant love, and then in the succeeding years, up through 41, 44, 46, every week I listened to Columbia Presents Corwin and fell madly in love with this director, writer, producer, the greatest director, writer, producer in the history of radio. No one touched him, and not even Orson Welles. And God knows we all admire Orson Welles, but I think Welles would be the first to say that as a writer, director, producer, that's what Norman was. Well, Welles could never write, and so you're missing one facet, aren't you? So when I published my first book in 1946, 47, Dark Carnival, I had been writing radio shows for Suspense for Bill Spear, and I got into radio and I did a whole series of things for the Columbia Workshop and various other shows. When my first book was published, I searched around at Columbia Studios trying to find someone who had Norman Corwin's address or phone number, and I got it out of one of the secretaries there, and I dared to call my hero, and he sounded a little suspicious for a moment. I said, well, all I want is to send my first book to you because I love what you've done over the years, and if you like it well enough, maybe I could buy you a drink some afternoon. So I sent him a copy of the book, autographed, and 2 weeks later, he called me back. He says, you're not taking me to drinks, I'm taking you to dinner. And we have been friends for the last 28 years since that phone call. And he's been a huge influence on my life, you know, criticizing my work, instructing me as to aesthetics, helping me when it came time to go to New York for the first time when I was 29 and very poor indeed. My wife was pregnant, and Norman said, for God's sake, go to New York and meet some of those people. You have all these beautiful stories, and you deserve to be published. And I went off to New York, and he and his wife met me there and took me around. So it's been a long friendship. And the first man I called when I got the job of writing Moby Dick from John Huston was Norman Corwin. I had lunch with him before I left for Europe, just to get some instructions on Herman Melville from Norman, because he knew and loved his work. So you see, it's been a steadfast thing over the years, and I've always wanted to have a show with Norman, to write for him and to be with him. And something has always frustrated us. And finally, this year, a young lady named Jackie Segerman came along and said, hey, it's time we put you together. And Ray, you write a couple of shows, and Norman, you produce and direct them. So we've done the first two. One, an Irish story of mine called The Great Conflagration Up at the Place, and another one, a science fiction thing about Thomas Wolfe being borrowed out of his deathbed in 1938 and taken by time machine into the future to write about space and all the fabulous things in space. And we have done these two shows as the beginning for our own series, hopefully this winter sometime on public broadcasting, if we can get the money and all the other things that go with it. But the first two shows are sublime. I have rarely heard anything so good, so fine in the history of radio. And it's not because they're my stories, it's because Norman, along with what I have to offer, Norman is so good at casting, so pertinent, so sensitive as a human being to the needs of his actors. And the sound, everything is so absolutely on the nose. So wish us luck. And with luck, we will have the series on this winter and do 30, 35. I'll write about half of them and bring in some of my friends to write the other half.
When are the one of the first two going to be broadcast?
Right? I don't know right now. I hope sometime in December. It's just a matter of that horrible thing of everyone saying they love it. Everyone back east in Washington, New York has heard him and has said, oh my God, this is terrific. You know, this is what radio was always meant to be. Especially in a culture like ours, it's so stupid, isn't it, how language has gone out of style. And Norman, if he wasn't anything else, was language and love of language, love of poetry, our greatest instructor to language, really, in our time. And that's got to come back. It's been missing from the theater. It's missing in most of television. You sit there, and it's data collecting and data broadcasting, isn't it? And that's not enough. You've got to take the facts and interpret them. Interpretation is everything in this world. And the quality of a civilization is the quality of its interpretation. Its ability to collect data, yes, by all means, correct data. But then what do you do with it after you get it? Huh? You can use it as Hitler did. You can use it as most of our politicians do, which means do nothing with it, Republican and Democrat. You can take that data and hand it to militarists, they'll use it one way. To philosophers and others, to psychiatrists, they'll overanalyze it ad infinitum, ad nauseum. So Norman to me is still the hero that he was. And I would like to return poetry and language and ideas to the center of our culture where they belong.
Imagination is the word that links you and Norman Corwin and most good writers today. The problem with television is there's no imagination. But when you sit down before a radio microphone with a script, you have the entire mind to call upon. And of all of the science fiction writers with which I am familiar, and it's a fairly decent number, the idea of doing a Ray Bradbury story in terms of just turning the imagination loose is just so exciting. When I heard about the project, I was really excited for it and looking forward to hearing it. And I can think of only one other person who's primarily radio with whom you could have established a partnership to work in this medium, and that is Arch Obler.
That's true, yes. I remember listening to a lot of his things when I was 16, 17. Well, see, my root system goes back so deeply into radio. I was 2 years old when radio came to birth in America. That's 1922, with the little crystal radios and sitting around my grandma's front room and listening to broadcasts. And I moved to Tucson, Arizona when I was 12, and Chandu the Magician came on. And God Almighty, I was just fantastically in love with Chandu the magician. I have lived most of my life at the top of my voice, and it's the only way to live. I can't imagine people not living at the top, at a shout and a shriek all the time. Because just the ability to fall madly in love and to stay in love, no matter what anyone says. And because of radio, it changed my life in many ways. Just listening to all the broadcasts, the early Sherlock Holmes shows, 1930-31, done by G. Washington's Coffee, Eno Crime Club, all those lovely things. But I got to Tucson, Arizona, and I was in the seventh grade, and I had begun to write short stories, and I was under the influence of Edgar Rice Burroughs and Tarzan, those wonderful Harold Foster drawings every Sunday in the newspaper, beautiful stuff, and it turns out I had fabulous taste because it's still around and it's admired by everyone in the world. The French and the Italians are reprinting all of Harold Foster's beautiful material, and I've been in touch with him the last 30 years telling him that I love him, and he's a man in his 80s now and still drawing on occasion. But anyway, got out to Tucson, listened to the radio, Chandu the magician's on, said to all my friends, been doing a lot of acting as a boy magician on the stage, I'm going to go down to the radio station and get a job. And everyone says, oh, come on now, you mean you really think you, a 12-year-old boy, can go down and get a job? Have you ever acted on the radio? No. Does your father know anyone there? No. Mother? Any other relatives? No. You mean you're just going to go down there, hang around? They're going to hire you? I said, yeah, I'm going to be irresistible. So I went down to the radio station and I emptied out ashtrays and I ran for newspapers and I just kept my nose pressed against the glass and watched. And by God, within 2 weeks I knew everyone at the station and I was reading the comic strips to the kiddies every Saturday night with a bunch of other kids. And I got free passes to all the local movies, King Kong, huh? The Mummy, Dracula. I mean, I was living high off the hog, huh? God, isn't that something? It was a combination then of my three great loves, movies, reading comic strips, and being on the radio. But to show you with what intensity I lived, and I've lived ever since, the owner of the radio station, every night when they finished broadcasting Chandu the Magician, it was on a huge 16-inch transcription, which was breakable, he'd bring it out in the garage behind the radio station. And he'd crack it over his knees and throw it into a garbage can.
Ouch.
And I followed him out one night. I was in tears. I said, please give that to me. I'm not going to do anything with it. I'm not going to take it anywhere. What can a 12-year-old boy do with it? He was a mean son of a bitch. Huh? He broke it right in front of me and threw it in the trash can. And when he was gone, I took the pieces out and saved them. I had them around the house for 20 years. And I could play with my fingernail pieces of words off that, pieces of music. You run your fingernail over it and you hear, you know, a little piece of the theme. That is the way I lived and I've always lived. And I've never forgiven that man. And that's 45 years ago now. And I've always lived at this peak, wanting things this badly and never forgiving people if they didn't give me something that, after all, didn't cost them anything. So, but that was my introduction to radio. And then I got into suspense later, and Harry Junkin worked with him on a program out of New York City, the name of which I've long since forgotten. It was one of those anthology things in the late 40s. So my love goes way back, and I hope extends into the future.
Well, you've got a lot of people out there that would sympathize with you on that breaking of a 16-inch disc.
Oh, yes.
My gosh.
Yes.
That is just a shame.
Ray, let me ask you a question which doesn't have to do with radio, but has a lot to do with you. In the famous novel by Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and in George Orwell's specifically in George Orwell's 1984, there is a room called Room 101. In that room is the primordial fear of each human being. What's in your Room 101?
Oh, dear. I suppose a number of things could be there. I keep remembering Lauren Isley's wonderful article that was in Harper's 20 years or so ago. When, as a explorer of caves, he was somewhere in Arizona, he let himself down into a cave and turned on his flashlight and found himself surrounded by about a billion spiders. Well, I don't know if you get out of there fast or if you just drop dead of a heart attack. I suppose I'd do combinations of both dying and leaving. I suppose something like that would be in my room.
Is that one of the reasons for writing, to exorcise things like that? Not perhaps spiders, but to learn about yourself and to perhaps, by doing that, communicate and to share with others your feelings and your solutions or...
Yeah, sure. Any accumulated fear. Most writers start with terrors. If they have any sense at all, you get to a certain age, when you're between 12 and 20, when you discover the world means you. You really discover for the first time not only that you're alive, but that you can die. You're suddenly very vulnerable. And I had a huge fear of the dark. So you start with that. And you never leave it. And the reason I'm a good writer, I know now, I look back, I was discussing this earlier tonight. I've stayed in close contact with my sense of smell and touch and color, taste, all these sensations. I'm a very primal writer. And when I go into a library, the first thing I do is open a book and smell it. You don't read it, you smell it, first of all, because books smell great. And they smell differently from every country because the ink is different, the paste is different, the paper is different. And I love old bookstores because of the smell. That's part of being a writer and a reader. And any library that doesn't smell like a library is not a library to me. It's something else again, but it's not a library. It's a new machine, but it's not a library. So I've always stayed very close to my feelings. We live in an age that's afraid of its feelings. And as a result, people have to go out and buy what I already give them. I give it to them practically free. You know, you can get a paperback of one of my books for 75 cents to $1.25. And you got all the stuff in there if you pay attention to it. Or you go to one of my lectures free. If you listen to me, I'll tell you to listen to your gut, not your head, because your gut and your head are connected anyway. But if you don't listen to your ganglion, what's at the center, right below the heart here, if you don't listen to your stomach telling you what the world is about, you're going to get sick, because that's what gets sick first. And that's getting messages from your brain, of course. That means you're hanging around with the wrong people, you're doing the wrong things, you're not doing the things you should be doing, artistically or any other way. You're in the wrong job, you got the wrong marriage, you got the wrong friends. Whatever it is, clean it out. Find out what it is and clean it away. You don't need a psychiatrist for this. You just need to listen to your total body. You don't have to go off to EST, you don't have to go to Scientology. Just stay in constant touch with your body and your mind for a lifetime, starting when you're 10. And that is where I've been lucky, because I just regurgitate into my typewriter at breakfast and clean up at noon. That's what writing is. And it's many things, you can put many labels on it, but being really afraid of the dark and getting that on paper, admitting you think death is the great enemy, and every time you finish your book and drop it in the mail, it's a triumph, and you say, one up on you, Mr. Death, one up on you. That's what it's all about. So, and then one up for life, you know. God bless life.
Incidentally, the novel that Ray Bradbury wrote, he's written very few novels, but this is one, talking about that fear of the dark, is called Something Wicked This Way Comes. And if anybody out there who is listening has not read it, immediately go to a bookstore or a library, lay your hands upon a copy, and I'm willing to bet that after you read it, you will not want to walk home in the dark.
I get probably more mail on that book than anything else I've ever written. I get love letters about it. I get, now that people hear it's being made into a film, I get people writing me and casting it and telling their favorite scenes and how to do this and that. And it's just beautiful. I love it. And in fact, one of my honorary sons, Paul Clemens, who's the son of Eleanor Parker, who's been a friend of mine for several years now, suggested some things a couple of months ago I'm going to use in a script. You know, they're that good. They're that brilliant, that beautiful. But as we were saying, you know, by living closely with primal things, that book is a metaphor for the entirety of life. I didn't intend it to be, but that's the way it is. It's the whole damn passion of life. Without getting pontifical about it, without intellectualizing about it, I'm speaking now tonight looking back at what I did automatically out of a sense of fun and loving death and here we got Halloween coming up now, which is one of the great holidays in this country, and it's ignored. And again, you see, I'm doing things that are perfectly obvious, and the people neglect them because they're obvious. Huh? So that you don't get books done on celebrating summer. You don't get books done on the history of death and what Halloween is. And I went to the library a couple of years ago, 10 years back, and I started doing some research on Halloween, which has always been my favorite holiday. Just loved it dearly. And when people call here on Halloween night and ask for me, my wife laughs, says, that's ridiculous. He's out tricking and treating with the girls, which I have for a life, and I still do. And a couple of years ago, some of my older daughters gave it up for a year, and because it was too childish, you know. And then they called me the next year and said, hey, we're coming back, we miss it. I said, that's right, it's fun. And it's sad, and it's joyful, and it's meant to be. It's a reaffirmation of life. It's a visiting of the dead. And I went off to the library to look for books on Halloween. There weren't any. And the last one written and published in the United States was around 1918. It's just a sort of history of the Druids and the Roman pagan rituals and the Egyptian gods and the harvest gods and what have you. Mithras, the Persians. And I said, well, my gosh, someone's got to do something about this. If we all love it this much, if some of us love it more than Christmas. So I got in and started reading where I could find articles here and there, and then I went into books of mythology and picked up shreds here and there. And I sat down and wrote a book called The Halloween Tree, which is a death journey, an examination of death in every age of mankind through all the civilizations, a grand adventure with 8 or 9 kids who show up at a household run by a man named Mountshroud, who is obviously Mr. Death himself. And he points at each of the
Okay,
children.
Well, we do need to interrupt because we're on very limited time this morning. And, you know, wonderful insight into the Halloween tree there. And he won an Emmy Award later on for a screenplay adaptation of the Halloween tree. So this is a story that you should make yourself familiar with. But you can make yourself familiar with more of Ray Bradbury. You can get that entire interview, plus my entire, Jerry Handiges and Mike Hodel. That's from October 1976. My interview from November 2000. And about 20 hours of radio dramas and little special things, even a TV commercial that Max is putting together, and I will, you know, assist a little bit on. But Max Schmid has been compiling this amazing thing. Now, we want to hear a full, uninterrupted radio drama this morning, don't we? We would love to hear another classic radio drama, And the Moon Be Still as Bright, from a Dimension XX. That would be X minus one. 2 weeks ago, we heard A Sound of Thunder. Last week, we listened to Dwellers in Silence. And this week, we will hear And the Moon Be Still as Bright. If. We have like only 5 minutes. And we have to raise money in that 5 minutes. Okay? So in order to be able to play this radio drama, we need calls. So for $60, for your gift of $60 to listener-sponsored WBAI, we will give you a gift of 2 CDs. Of MP3s, that means that we can put a lot onto each disc of Ray Bradbury radio dramas, including what started out as Paul Wonder's recreation of the Martian Chronicles, taking all the Dimension X, X minus ones, and some later productions of stories, individual stories that make up the mosaic novel that is The Martian Chronicles are actually serial short stories, not really a mosaic novel. But it's short stories that become a novel and tell this epic tale of the Martian Chronicles. So we have the Martian Chronicles, we have Dandelion Wine, we have some stories from the Illustrated Man, we have all the classic radio dramas and a few modern ones, at least two, maybe three productions of Kaleidoscope, the classic Sound of Thunder, some radio dramas, at least one from South Africa, from SF-68, I think the name of the show was. And although the show was in 1969, all this stuff as a thank you for your donation to WBAI of $60. One phone call is currently coming in. That's been there for a while. I believe it will become a pledge, but we need more calls. We have three people in the room at the moment ready to take your call. And we would like to start converting those into pledges, as they say, and, you know, conversions and all that, all this marketing speak. But what we need here is radio speak. We need you to call and pledge now. The phone number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And you will go to show that, A, happy birthday, happy 90th birthday, Ray Bradbury. That's tomorrow, Sunday. And we're going to be doing more Bradbury stuff on the Golden Age of Radio on his birthday. B, that Hour of the Wolf on WBAI on these airwaves since 1972, the idea of science fiction radio, speculative fiction, fantasy, and all that stuff like that there is something that you treasure and believe should be on the air. It is all so rare to find that, and it is really listener-sponsored radio that does the job. Wherever you may find a program like this, and may I say there really aren't too many shows like this, that'll be at a station like this. There's a second call. Thank you very much. 212-209-2950. So the second point is to show the powers that be here. I wasn't even going to be on this week. I was preempted till I mentioned to the program director that, you know, it's Bradbury's 90th birthday. And said, oh, okay, well, in honor of that, I'll let you do your show. But you know, Simon's show's still truncated, so I'm sharing some of my time with him. But, you know, we need to show the powers that be here that thank you for putting this on. Thank you for recognizing that this is something that we want to have on the air besides all the other stuff that you've been hearing during this fundraising drive. This is something that you value. You want to hear more of this and less of the recordings of the various premiums that for the most part have been heard during this marathon. You can make a vote for this and more of this by calling now. And really, it's now 6 a.m. If I start the radio, how long is that radio drama exactly? I'll cue it up and then I will know. Because I'm getting off at 6:30. Oh, it's half an hour. So, I mean, I need to put it on right now. But in order to put it on right now, I need some more calls. 212-209-2950. Two calls are currently coming in. Let's get two or three more, and I will start the radio drama, and we will hear the whole thing. We don't get them. I would hate to sacrifice that on such a special occasion. There's a third call. Thank you very much. So we will succeed. We are doing this thanks to your help, thanks to your support. Let's get another call in there, and I'll consider that happiness for now. 212-209-2950. Make a call. Make a pledge. $60. Well, $25 makes you a member of WBAI. Oh, I said there were three things that you were pledging for. Number one, Ray Bradbury's birthday. Number two, Hour of the Wolf on WBAI. Number three, WBAI itself. You go to keep listener-sponsored radio on the air. Over 90% of our funding comes from these phone calls. We don't do the grants. We don't do all that other stuff. We aren't supported by underwriting this and that and the other thing. We're supported by your phone calls directly. $1 gets us $1. It's not matched by Megalith Associates or this service or that. It's donations that you make, and your donations therefore mean that much more. Three calls are coming in. Let's get one more, please. One more call. 212-209-2950. Make that call now and we can start one of the classic Bradbury pieces, "And the Moon Be Still as Bright." 212-209-2950. This radio drama is, Lord help us, nearly 60 years old itself. Bradbury tomorrow, 90 years old. Hour of the Wolf, oh, about 38 years old. Me, I don't even want to talk about it. I've been working here since 1967, and I was 13. You do the math. 212-209-2950. One more call, please. One more pledge, and we will start this radio drama. There it comes. Thank you. As soon as that is picked up so that I know it's a real call coming in, I will know that it's not just ringing. And please, by the way, do bear in mind that it will take a little while. We only have three people in that room and four calls coming in, now three calls coming in. So, you know, please be a little bit patient while we get to you. But yes, you have done what I asked for, so I will now done what I gone and promised. But that doesn't stop you, by the way, from still pledging. 212-209-2950. And now set your way back machine to November 29th, 1950.
Adventures in time and space, told in future tense.
Dimension X, 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 X.
Tonight, transcribed from Ray Bradbury's collection, The Martian Chronicles, we present, "And the Moon Be Still as Bright." The first three expeditions to Mars left Earth in a mushroom of flame, arced through the atmosphere, and finally dwindled to tiny specks in the big eye of Mount Palomar telescope, and then were lost to sight forever. The prearranged landing signals flashed back to Earth, and then the radios went dead. One after the other, ships had disappeared and were never heard from again. But still the rockets came. The fourth expedition emerged from the silent gulfs of space and angled down toward the floating red disk of Mars, down into an orbit, as the order came to land.
Stand by for deceleration.
Deceleration, aye, sir.
Skids down.
Skids down, sir.
Engine room.
Engine room, aye.
Landing procedure, fire 1, 3, and 5.
Aye, sir.
The last blast of the bow jets broke red against the blue desert sands, and the ship slid to a halt at the edge of a vast city that reflected the icy glare of the moonlight. For a while, all was still.
All right, Parkhill. Open the airlock.
Aye, sir.
Fresh air.
How about a fire, Captain Wyler? It's freezing.
Later. We got work to do.
Smell that air. You could get drunk on it. Say, there's an idea. Why don't we break out a bottle and celebrate?
Biggs, there'll be no drinking done till we're secured.
But we're landed, Captain.
Three other expeditions landed and disappeared within 24 hours. We're not relaxing security till we find out what happened to them.
Maybe Martians?
Exactly, Parkhill. Spender, you're an archaeologist. How old would you say those buildings are? Somebody built these cities?
Oh, I can't tell till I study them more closely. It's a kind of engineering we couldn't duplicate on Earth. Those thin, reed-like towers and the stone filigree wouldn't stand up under Earth pressure. Beautiful, aren't they?
I'm not interested in the architecture now. I want to make sure there's nothing there that might be dangerous. Mr. Hathaway.
Yes, sir.
I want you to take a reconnaissance party into the city and find out what's there.
The cities all look dead from the air, sir.
They look dead, but I want to make sure. Mr. Spender, you better go with Hathaway.
Yes, sir.
Don't waste any time gathering relics either. You can make an archaeological study later. Right now, I want a security report. Biggs?
Yes, sir.
We'll set up camp right here. No man is to go more than 50 feet from the rocket. And there'll be no celebration till Hathaway and his party report back.
No, sir. It's just that we've been cooped up in the...
That's all, Biggs. We've landed safely. We're not safe yet. Not until we know what we're up against here. We'll maintain full security till Hathaway gets back.
In the sea bottoms, the wind stirred along faint vapors, and from the mountains great stone visages looked upon the silvery rocket and the small fire. The sky was black overhead as the two racing moons threw knife-edged double shadows on the desert.
All right, come and get it. Chow.
What you got to eat, Cherokee?
Sawdust, smothered in cold lamb fat.
Good. I thought it was something I couldn't eat. Hey, you guys, pipe down. Captain, Mr. Hathaway's back.
Captain Wiley.
Over here, Mr. Hathaway.
Well?
Most of the city is dead, sir. Spender says it's been dead a good many thousand years. But we found one part about a mile over.
What about it?
People were living in it last week, sir.
People?
Martians.
I see. Where are they now?
Dead. We found the bodies. Thousands of bodies. They hadn't been dead more than 10 days.
What did they die of?
You won't believe it.
What killed them?
Chicken pox.
Chicken pox?
Yes, I made tests. It worked differently on Martians than on Earth people. Burned them black and dried them out to brittle flakes.
But where could they get chicken pox?
From Earth, sir.
And the other rockets did get through.
Yes, sir. I don't know what the Martians did to them, but I sure know what they did to the Martians. Gave them chicken pox and wiped them out. They just didn't have any resistance to an Earth disease.
There aren't any of them left?
There won't be any. When a thing like that starts spreading, sir, there's no stopping it anywhere. It's 1,000 to 1 that's killed them all. This planet is through.
Incredible.
Think of it, Captain. A dirty, silly child's disease like chicken pox. It isn't right.
Spender, take it easy,
man. No, it's like saying the Greeks died of mumps or the proud Roman Empire collapsed because of athlete's foot. We didn't even give them a decent excuse for dying. We just gave them chicken pox.
Spender, get hold of yourself.
You didn't see those bodies, Captain.
It must have been a shock, I suppose. You need a rest, a little relaxation. Martians are dead. There's nothing you can do about it now.
Hey, you hear that? The Martians are all dead. Well, come on, let's break out a bottle and whoop it up. How about it, Captain?
Well, all right, man.
Oh, that's fine.
Hathaway, see to the security guard.
Yes, sir.
Good Lord, do they have to do that now?
It's been a tough trip. It's only natural they'd want to celebrate a little.
Celebrate because a world died? Because a rotten little virus from Earth wiped out a whole civilization?
Well, they're not thinking of
that.
Isn't
there time later to throw old beer cans into the canals? A civilization died here. It's like butchering a pig in a churchyard.
Spender, you think too much. We're lucky to get to Mars without catching a meteor in our bulkheads. Let it go at that.
Safe on Mars. The first statement, safe on Mars. We gotta celebrate. Yahoo!
Many bottles were opened and drunk. The voices got louder. The earth laughs and shouts echoing across the empty Martian sands.
There was that time in New York when I ran into that blonde. Boy, what a blonde. Listen, the first thing she said...
Spender listened to the wind over his ears, cool and whispering. He felt the land getting cooler. The stars drew closer, very clear. The air smelled clean and new. He looked at the cool ice of the white Martian buildings over there on the empty sea lands.
What a woman! What a woman! Hey, what do we do with these empty bottles?
Save them. There's a 2-cent deposit.
Throw them away. Hey, wait. How about that building? 2 to 1 for a buck, I can heave one right through that window.
You're right.
Here goes.
Bullseye!
I owe him a buck.
Double or nothing on the next shot?
Put that bottle down, Figs.
Who's that, Mr. Spender?
Stop smashing those windows.
What's the difference? The planet's ours now. I guess I can do anything with it that I want.
Drop that bottle, I'll knock your teeth out.
Yeah? Just watch me.
I warned you, Big Head.
Spender, what is this?
I hit him.
He's crazy, Captain. He just walked up and slugged me.
Biggs wasn't doing nothing.
All right, let go of him. You men, go back to your party. Spender, come with me.
I like that guy. Just walks up to him and slugs me. What?
Spender, suppose you explain. What was the idea?
Oh, the noise, the drunken brawl. I guess I was ashamed of the spectacle the whole crew was making. Where's their respect for what's happened? Their sense of what's right?
Men are tired. It's been a long trip. You've got a different way of seeing things.
I'm seeing things all right. I'm seeing how we'll ruin Mars. We'll rip it up, rip the skin off the way we've already ruined Earth. We Earthmen have a talent for ruining big, beautiful things.
Is that why you hit Biggs?
Yes, I couldn't stand the idea of them watching us make fools of ourselves.
Them?
The Martians.
The Martians? They're dead. All dead.
But they know we're here. Doesn't an old thing always know when a new thing comes? We've come a long way to smash their windows and spit in their wine.
Well, maybe you're right. I'm fining you $50 for that fight. Now suck in your chin. We'll go back there and play happy.
Now the whole party moved out into the moonlight across the desert. They made their way into the dreaming dead city. The light of the racing twin moons glinted on the barrel of a pistol, the long blade of a machete, the round, gurgling shape of a raised bottle. Their shadows under them were double shadows on the ice-blue sand. They were waiting, waiting for something to stir in the dead city, something to rise, some ancient ancestral shape to come galloping across the vacant sea bottom on an ancient, armored steed of impossible lineage, of unbelievable derivation.
Look at it, Captain. Down those avenues in the mist. You can almost see them.
The mind's eye populated the dead city. Each window was given a person who leaned from it and waved slowly, as if under some timeless water, at some moving form in the fathoms of space below the moon-silvered towers. There were faint murmurs of sound, and odd animals scurrying across the gray-red sands. The wind blew in from the dead sea bottom and brushed through the silvery wire filigree of the towers. A strange music drifted down to the double-shadowed streets, a thin, haunted music that played as it had played through the uncounted years of time. Nobody moved. The moons held and froze them. The wind beat slowly around them.
Hey, out there! You people in the city!
Pigs.
Why, I just wanted to make a little noise.
Come on.
They built this city thousands of years ago. And now where are they? How did they die?
Who cares? They're dead. It's good enough for me.
Lord Byron.
What?
Lord Byron, an old 19th century poet. He wrote a poem that fits this city. Might have been written by the last Martian. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night. Though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears the sheath, and the soul outwears its breast. And the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself must rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
Without a word, the Earthmen stood in the center of the city. It was a clear night. There was not a sound except the music of the wind. At their feet lay a tile court worked into the shapes of ancient animals and images. They stood there, silvered by the double moons beneath the crystal towers of Mars. And then Biggs was sick, and the sour stench of liquor filled the cool air. The men of Earth had come to Mars. And Spender turned and walked away into the city. Alone in the moonlight, never once stopping to look back.
That you, Hathaway?
Yes, sir. My trick on Bridgewater, sir.
What time is it?
0400. Any orders, sir?
No, I'll stay on watch. You turn in.
Aren't you sleeping, sir?
I'll wait for Spender.
He didn't come in?
No.
He's crazy. Walking away into the shadows, he didn't even look back.
Spender is a strange man.
He's crazy, sir.
How's the rest of the crew?
Sleeping it off. Biggs had DTs, but he's calmed down now.
You can go back below, Hathaway. I'll take your watch.
Captain Wilder, do you think Spender'll be coming in before morning?
I don't know.
You know, sir, I don't think he's ever coming back. That's the way I feel about him, sir. He'll never come back.
It was a morning that might have been a Monday, or a Tuesday, or any day on Mars. Biggs was on the canal rim, his feet hung down in the cool water soaking, while he took the sun in his face.
What are you doing back here, Biggs? Didn't you go out with his search party?
Yeah, I come back. I got a blister.
Sure.
What do you mean? Look, Cherokee, you see that? Anyway, I had enough searching. 4 days hunting for that screwball Spender.
Didn't find him yet, huh?
Nah, good riddance. Oh, my feet, I'm gonna soak them good. If I was wild, I wouldn't worry about that nut Spender. Let him go. He's a crackpot anyway.
Yeah, a little foggy upstairs, I guess. Why don't you take your feet out of that canal, Biggs? I gotta make coffee out of that water.
Coffee? You call that stuff coffee? I had a motorcycle once that dripped grease that tasted better than that...
Wait a minute. Biggs, look over there.
Where?
By that bush. There's someone there.
Hey.
It's him. Hey, Spender!
Spender?
Yeah, he's coming over.
Why didn't he stay lost, the crazy jerk?
Hi, Spender. Long time no see.
Hello, Cherokee. I've been exploring some ruins.
You and them ruins. You're like a dog in a boneyard. What's the matter? Where you been?
Up in the hills. What would you say if I told you I found a Martian?
Huh. Where? Yeah.
Never mind. Let me ask you a question. How would you feel if you were a Martian and people came to your land and started to tear it up?
I know how I'd feel. I've got Cherokee blood in me. My grandfather told me lots of things about the way they kicked the Indians around in the Oklahoma Territory. If there's any Martian around, I'm all for him.
How about you, Biggs?
They're dead. They're all dead. A good thing, too.
Well, I found a Martian up in a dead town in the hills. I've been reading their books. They're easy to understand. I've learned their language. Then I found this Martian. He said, give me your boots, and I did. He said, give me your uniform, and I gave him my uniform.
You're crazy, Spender. Hey, Cherokee, he's crazy.
And the Martian said, give me your gun, and I gave him my gun, and then he said, come along and watch what happens. And the Martian walked down into camp, and he's here now.
I don't see no Martian.
I'm the last Martian.
What?
Biggs, I'm going to kill you.
Cut it out. What kind of a lousy joke is that?
Stand up and take it.
Hey, put that gun away, Spender.
Yeah, cut it, Spender.
Don't. Put that gun away. You're joking. You're kidding, huh? Spender!
He's dead. You killed him.
You can come with me, Cherokee. You know how the Martians would feel. You can be in this with me.
You killed him. You just killed him.
He deserved it.
You're crazy.
Well, maybe I am. But you can come with me.
Come with you? For what? Go on, get out of here, you crazy murderer.
All of them, I thought you'd understand. I thought you'd remember what happened to your own people.
You get out of here, you crazy
Don't
murderer.
Don't reach for that gun.
Spender.
Spender.
dead, Captain Wilder.
Who's missing?
Only Spender. It must have been him, sir.
Why didn't he come and talk to me? Why didn't
he... Should have talked to me. I'd have shot his brains out. That's what I'd have done.
He took him by surprise. There's no sign of a struggle.
Hathaway, break out the arms locker. Issue pistols, rifles, and grenades.
Yes, sir.
You better get the Bible out of the navigation chest. We'll have to bury these two. Parkhill.
Aye, sir.
You start digging a grave.
How about Spender?
We'll have to go up in the hills and find him.
Just let me at him with my bare hands. Crazy murdering louse.
That's enough, Parkhill. The man is sick. He must be.
Sick, my
That's enough.
Eye.
Now grab a shovel. Start digging.
Spender saw the thin dust rising in the valley, and he knew the pursuit was beginning. The sun burned farther up the sky, and the blue sand drifted lazily across the sea bottom below. He sat beside a quiet pool, 10,000 years old, and held a silver book. Through the house played the strange wind music of ancient Mars, and he heard voices whisper in his mind.
Earthman, Earthman.
I hear you. Earthman. I've always heard you, even down there on Earth.
Run.
I won't run. What's the use?
Run. Earthman.
Live, what for? To see them tear down your temples and put up hot dog stands?
Run.
They've seen me. They know I'm up here.
Live.
There's Wilder now. Got him right in my sights. Funny he hasn't ordered him to use grenades. He could lob one right up here and blow me to bits. Yeah, maybe the captain thinks I'm too nice to be blown to bits. He wants my death to be clean. Yeah, just one bullet hole in me, nothing messy. And why? Because he understands me.
Kill.
Yes, the only one in the crew who ever did. Well, at least I can do the same for him.
Kill.
Just one bullet in his heart, a nice clean death.
Kill.
All I have to do is pull the trigger and then... It's no use, I can't do it to him.
Fender! Spender, can you hear me, Spender?
Yeah, I hear you, Captain. What do you want?
Talk! Truce!
All right, come on up. Leave your gun down there and keep your hands up.
Spender, are you there?
Over here.
It's quite a climb. Mind if I sit down? Cigarette?
Thanks.
Light?
Yeah, got my own.
It's warm.
Yeah, it is.
You comfortable up here in the hills?
Quite.
How long do you think you can hold out?
About 12 men's worth.
Why didn't you kill all of us this morning when you had the chance? You could have.
I know. I got sick. After I started killing people, I realized they were just fools and I shouldn't be killing them. But it was too late, so I came up here where I could get angry again.
Why did you do it?
Because I've seen that what these Martians had was just as good as anything we'll ever hope to have. They stopped where we should have stopped 100 years ago. They knew how to combine science and art and religion. They knew how to live with dignity and peace.
And for that reason, you started shooting people?
Look, when I was a kid, my folks took me to visit Mexico City. I'll always remember the way my father acted, loud and big. My mother didn't like the people because they were dark and didn't wash enough. I can see my mother and my father coming to Mars and acting the same way. Anything that's strange is no good to us. We aren't fit to take over this planet.
But kill two men.
What could I do? It's me against the whole Earth. Isn't it enough they've ruined one planet? Now they want to ruin this one. I'll kill you all off, Wilder. That'll delay the next rocket 5 years. And I'll kill them, too. If I'm lucky, I'll live to be 60. And I'll meet every expedition that lands on Mars. I'll be very friendly. I'll explain that our rocket blew up one day. And I'll kill them off. I'll save Mars for half a century. And by then, maybe the Earth people will give up.
You got it all planned.
Yes.
Yet you're outnumbered. We already have you surrounded. In an hour, you'll be dead.
I found an underground passage. It'll take me back into the hills, Wilder. I'll go back there, and then I'll pick you off one by one.
We'll see. It's a nice town you got here, Spender. Beautiful. I'd like to live here.
You can. But join me. You're not like them. I'll show you what a good life these people had. I'll play you an old reel of Martian music that must be at least 50,000 years old, a kind of music you've never heard in your life.
That sounds wonderful. But I can't stay with you. Sorry, Spender. I'm sorry this is happening.
I guess you'd better go back now so you can start your attack.
I guess so.
But, Captain, I won't kill you. When it's all over, you'll still be alive. Then maybe you'll change your mind.
No. There's too much Earth blood in me. I may even agree with you about all this. But that doesn't change what I've got to do.
You won't stay?
No. This is your last chance, Spender. You're sick. Come along with me quietly.
No. Look, one last thing. If you win, do me a favor. Try to see that they don't tear this planet apart.
Right.
If it helps, just think of me as a very crazy fellow who went berserk one summer day. It'll be easier on you that way.
I'll think it over. So long, Spender.
Bye, Captain. Good luck.
We'll go after him now. Hathaway, you take the right. I'll lead on the left. You have to kill him. He won't come down. Make it a clean shot if you can. Get it over with.
I'll blow his bloody brains out.
No, Parkhill.
His bloody
through the heart.
Brains.
You heard what I said. Through the heart. Now let's go get him.
They spread out again, walking and then running on the hot hillside places where there would be sudden cool grottos that smelled of moss, and sudden open blasting places that smelled of sun on stone. The men ran and ducked, and ran and squatted in the shadows.
Blow his brains out! Just one slug, that's all he needs.
Captain Wilder hugged the rock warmed by the sun. He gasped, for the air was thin and not meant for running. Spender lay at the top of the hill, and a gap in the rocks showed the white of his shirt against the shadows. Wilder looked at the towers of the little clean Martian village like sharply carved chess pieces lying in the afternoon. He saw the rocks and the interval between where Spender's chest was revealed.
Go on, Spender, get out. You've only got a few seconds to escape. Get out to the caves and come back later. Go now, Spender, or I've got to end it. I've got to think I'm right and pull the trigger. Go now. Get out.
I'll get him. Slug in the head. I'll blow his bloody...
No, Parkhill. Put down that gun. I've got to do this myself. Spender, why didn't you get out? Why? Why?
They buried him in that ancient valley town where the music of the wind played on through the days and the nights. They laid him in an ancient silver sarcophagus with waxes and wines which were 10,000 years old. His hands folded on his chest. The last they saw of him was his peaceful face in the cold silver light of the racing twin moons. The captain found the poem in Spender's pocket, and he read it before he shut the marble door.
So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
The next afternoon, Parkhill did some target practice in one of the dead cities, shooting out the crystal windows and blowing the tops off the fragile towers. Captain Wilder caught Parkhill and nearly knocked his teeth out. All of you regular listeners to Dimension X will be interested to know that our show is changing its day and time of broadcast over this station. Starting early in November, we'll
yes,
be back
it's
at a
2010.
New time. We suggest you watch your local newspaper and be sure to join us in about 4 weeks for a new series of adventures into the unknown world of tomorrow. The world of...
Dimension
X, 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 X.
Tonight, Dimension X is transcribed, And the Moon Be Still as Bright, adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy from the original story by Ray Bradbury. Featured in the cast were Alexander Scorby as Spender, Wendell Holmes as Captain Wilder, and your host and narrator for the story, Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman, engineer Bill Chambers. Dimension X is directed by Edward King. This is Robert Warren speaking.
Alexander Scorby, no less. Wow. Yes, so, Dimension X, this is an abbreviation.
Enjoy the Life of Riley with William Bendix next Friday on NBC.
Yeah, he's living the life of Riley. Ah, there we go. Ding, dong, ding. Okay, yeah, that's the whole proper thing. And sorry to step on Dimension X, but we did get to play it for you, and we got to play it because we got four pledges. But my time is up this morning because Simon and I have had to shoehorn ourselves in order to be on at all. It wasn't clear we were going to be on at all, but I spoke to, and Simon spoke to the program director, and I was given my full show. He was given an abbreviated show. Problem is that he's got a whole thing planned out. So in order to do that, to get past the abbreviation, I am abbreviating mine. So HOTW is about to make way to AIP. Those are the abbreviations there. But I want to say, first of all, thank you to the people who pledged, one person being PA from Douglaston, New York, and another person being AW from Manhattan, and then John Mangan from, is that Fairfield? Yes, Fairfield, Connecticut, and Ronald, can I say the name on the air? Yes, I can, Ronald Feiner from Manhattan. So thank you all. That's three Bradbury premiums there. And you can still do that. This is your last opportunity during this fundraising drive to get it on this show. You know, Max is going to do a show, but Max always makes money because Max does a great show. And it's, you know. So that means that we need your support. Talking about being preempted, I was, you know, half the show's preempted, Simon is preempted and all that. Why? Well, you know, we're not going to get into the why. What we are going to say is when we make money, when we can show a record and say, hey, look, we're doing well, listeners want to hear this stuff during the fund drive, and listeners respond, then we have something to go in with and say, keep us on and don't preempt us during the fund drives, which is why we need you to call now. Join those four people, 212-209-2950. Now, next week, we are back to what for on this show passes as normal programming, and we are going to have a number of people from an anthology, a magazine, Sybil's Garage. If it sounds like the Altered Fluid people, well, there's a lot of crossover. Matt Kressel from Altered Fluid is the editor of Sybil's Garage, and he's going to have a whole bunch of writers, about five writers, who have had stories in there, and I think Paul Berger is in there. I know Barbara Krasnoff is in there. She hasn't been on this program live in, about 15 years, but she will be next week, along with Matt Kressel. So that will be a fun one. And, well, we have a whole September 11th will be Barry Molesberg. I have something. September 18th will be Altered Fluid, a short story read by Tempest Bradford, and then everybody, you know, dogpiles and critiques it. And, oh, we have something September. Oh, Brenda Clough. Brenda Clough will be coming up from Washington. And she's a wonderful writer and fascinating person and all that. September 25th, I'll have to talk to Simon and whatever. I'll probably be away. And yet I have a show planned for that morning. So exactly what's going to happen is something we're going to have to negotiate and figure out how that can work. And then October is Fantasy Month, and November is already being booked up. We have great things in store. But in order for that to happen, and November is probably our next fun drive, in order to not be preempted, we need your calls. We need your pledges now. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I am going off now. Not even time for sales of silver this morning. Although, by the way, yes, a new edition of some Steel I Span albums just out this week, as a matter of fact. I'll put a link up to it at ourwolf.com. It's like five albums, including Sales of Silver. So remastered. So, but no time for that this morning, because time for As I Please. So please, as you please, call now. 212-209-2950. I'm just, I'm moving out. Simon's moving in. We're compressing our arts programming this morning. We need, I need to go out with a couple of phone calls from you folks.
You can do this now. It's easily done. 212-209-2950. Keep this radio station alive. And right now, on behalf of Jim and myself, keep the literary ghetto of WBAI alive as well. 212-209-2950.
This time slot was originally given to Simon from 5 to 8:30. Before that was the morning after the night before, 5 to 8:30.
Yeah.
We were 5 to 7 on weekdays and 5 to 8:30 on weekends. Simon got the 5 to 8:30 slot, and his best friend bisected his show and threw me in there.
You know, I've just have no luck with friends. What can I say?
Yeah. But that was 1980, was it, approximately? When was it?
About 85, I guess.
That late. Yeah. That late. So, no, because I was already on Saturdays in 1984, wasn't I? Or I was still on Fridays?
I think you were still on Fridays.
Ah, okay. Hmm. Well, one way or the other.
When
was Steve program director?
1984.
Well, then that's when it happened.
Because
Steve was willing to do Orwell for 1984, but the following program director, Mr. Marksman, was not as interested in doing like a whole big Orwell reading. Not too late to do it, though.
Hey, it's as timeless as tomorrow's newspaper.
It really is, neither 1948 nor 1984. But it is 2010. It is the 21st century. My God help us all. Please make a phone call, 212-209-2950. I'd like to see one good call come in before I leave. You know, do it for Ray. Bradbury will be 90 years tomorrow. You don't have to make a softcore porn video. Well, it's not really porn, but it's
Frank language, however.
Is it Frank language? However, F me Ray Bradbury on YouTube by Rachel Bloom with Simon coming in. You'll remember the name Bloom, won't you? 212-209-2950. Go searching for this video and it's not even in June, but 212-209-2950. Let's get a call in celebrating what has been a month of Bradbury programming that will continue tomorrow night on the Golden Age of Radio. And I guess Tuesday night, Max probably has more planned. For that $60, you get two CDs filled with MP3s and bonus extras, including my interview with Ray Bradbury and the interview that we heard earlier done by Jerry Hendigas, which we didn't have time to play the whole thing, but you will get the whole thing on that two CD set. 212-209-2950. Let's get a call now. One call.
Is that too much to ask?
It is.
We've dragged ourselves in here at this ungodly hour of the morning in order to provide you listening pleasure.
Very godly.
Everybody it is actually.
It is ungodly, and I think no, it's very appropriate. It's very
well,
godly.
Frankly, you know, the Saturday morning is really the perfect time for the sort of programming that we do—an opportunity for you to sit still and listen. The rest of the week, you've got many things, you know. You got to get somewhere. But here's the time to get up, enjoy your cup of coffee, and listen to literature, be it science fiction or the highbrow crap that I throw at you.
Yes.
212-209-2950.
It's working the mind. It's relaxation while working the mind. Exercise for the mind. Do your mental sit-ups.
And speaking of Orwell, I do have Orwell for you this morning, which, of course, I hasten to point out, they wanted to cancel so they could raise more money. I say we can raise money and have Orwell,
and
it does
Bradbury.
Depend on you. 212-209-2950.
And Bradbury really followed in the Orwell tradition with some of his stories. The Pedestrian, I think, is one of the best Orwellian stories, you know, following from Orwell, not in the style of, don't do that. It has to be. There are windows up there.
Oh, all righty.
Tell you what. You talk about it. You try to get a phone call. I'll disconnect that.
And you are tuned to WBAI New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial. The time now is approximately 6:45, give or take a minute or two. The clocks in Master Control are notorious for revealing two different times as though there is a time zone within this room. And there just might be. And this is indeed the early start to As I Please, because As I Please gets an early start because it also has an early end this morning, running till 8 o'clock. And I have spent this morning applying the principle of trim to an essay by George Orwell. Cutting a little bit, but you can always find it at your public library. And, of course, Orwell is a must. And I think Orwell is not only an excellent writer, but a good model to us all as a decent human being. And that was a word that he would use often. He would often talk about the quality of decency, which is something that we might want to revive here at WBAI, a sense of decency about what we're doing.
A bit of Blair. Eric Blair is what I mean by a bit of Blair.
Eric Arthur Blair. One of the he hated the name Eric, by the way. He thought it sounded wimpy.
Where did George Orwell come from?
He liked the name George because it was manly. Orwell was a name of one of his favorite rivers in England.
Oh.
And he took that name just as a way to distance himself from Eric Blair. And because he liked the sound of it. And throughout his life, he would answer to Eric or to George. People knew him as both. And another aspect of Orwell, he was always a bit embarrassed about the fact that he went to Eton. And during World War II, Orwell worked at the BBC, doing propaganda, which, of course, informs 1984. And yet, one of the more astonishing things in the 20th century, for all those years at the BBC, there is not a recording of George Orwell's voice.
That's astonishing. That really is.
Maybe it's around somewhere in some back closet, but, you know, we really have to dig to try to find a recording of George Orwell.
Speaking of voices not being there, it is time for mine to transition and to thank that call that has indeed come in, and to thank Simon for being here, and even the powers that be that gave us the second thought and said, okay, you guys are on because of Bradbury and Orwell. But let me say one last thing. Happy birthday, Ray.
Happy birthday, Ray. Indeed. 90 years young.
Indeed. So good morning. I'll be back next week, and we give you Simon.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for the generosity of allowing me to impose myself upon what is your time. You remember Larry Josephson still thinks of Mondays through Fridays, 7 to 8:30 as his time.
Oh, absolutely.
And perhaps it is.
And there, you know, he didn't want initially. He resisted Hour of the Wolf coming on the air because he couldn't turn on the transmitter and be the first thing that was there. And the idea of his coming in, Margot being there, and worse, Margot and I. You know, so that was an issue in those days.
Yes. Well, you know, we often lapse into discussing WBAI history, and Of course, that's one reason for you to support WBAI so that in 10 years we can talk about the past 10 years. 212-209-2950. And it is now high time to begin as I please for this morning. Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. Yeah, will do. And I guess the best way to begin is to turn to our opening theme, which is about to come right here, right now. 212-209-2950. They expect me to raise money, eh? 212-209-2950. This is now as I please, starting 15 minutes early because we end a half hour early this morning for reasons no one has tried to explain to me. I don't think anyone can explain, really. It's just one of the mysteries of life. Now, let me say this then about that. I have something of a reputation for bringing you poetry. This morning, prose, but this morning, prose after on the topic of one of the great dramatic poems in the English language, King Lear. And this has been the summer series. But, you know, it is becoming more and more difficult to perform the summer series because of the endless preemptions that they give to you. Because when it comes down to it, you know, I come, I go, and so on, but this program exists for your pleasure. I know I call it, as I please, a George Orwell reference, and because I bring to you things that I like, that I love, I hope that it also pleases you as well. 212-209-2950. It is perhaps drastic to say that your support is the only assurance that this program will be here next week at its regular time. And we can't even make any promises in that regard. But we can say that WBAI needs your help now more than ever. I don't offer you premiums because I believe that radio is a non-material thing. We deal in poems and ideas. And perhaps they will last you for a while. If you have been a regular listener to WBAI or even a regular listener to As I Please and have for some reason or other not yet made a call of financial support, now, golly gee, now really is the time. And as they say on late night infomercials, which of course become more and more the programming here at WBAI, won't you please help? Won't you call now? 212-209-2950. I found out that I was preempted this week entirely by accident. For no apparent reason, for no good reason, I idly consulted the WBAI webpage, where I saw the pathetic tally for the thon so far. And then, idly, I clicked the little button that said schedule, discovering that I was essentially canceled for this week. Well, you can imagine, I was hopping mad, and I immediately called the radio station and was put on hold. Eventually, I got around to the acting interim fundraiser in charge, and I said, you know, I am in the midst of a series, which indeed has been a regular feature of As I Please every summer since 1991. It is the summer series. He said, what series? So there we are, 212-209-2950. You know, I do have work to do. The essay is a long one, even after applying the principle of trim. So I won't actually have a whole lot of time to cajole you into supporting WBAI, but I'm going to count on your intelligence and the decent thing to do to make another reference to George Orwell. And George Orwell, again, not only a model prose writer, clear and efficient, but I selected this essay because he is talking about King Lear, but not as a scholar, but as just a regular Joe, someone who has an interest in things literary, perhaps, but certainly accepts the work of William Shakespeare as part of the basic foundation of our language and a human point of view. And it is actually that. I mean, this week, Frank Kermode died. And, of course, who else at WBAI is fit to talk about Frank Kermode? I do not know. 212-209-2950. Another model of a literary critic who wrote in everyday language. In the past 20 or 30 years or so, literary criticism has become almost mathematical, with formulae and arcane, or shall we say, specific jargon terms that are very difficult to translate into common, everyday English. But Orwell speaks for us all. He has a quality of looking at things that is refreshing and honest. Now, I know that at this point there's a lot of discussion about just how honest George Orwell was, and is he of the left or is he of the right? And I think that's almost beside the point. Take him for all he was a man, for all of that, and a thoughtful man. And so this morning I want to turn to his essay, Lear, Tolstoy, and the Fool. But first, this important message. WBAI is a listener-sponsored radio station that depends upon the support of listeners to keep going. We may not be full strength. As a matter of fact, we are a bit. maybe we're 85% full strength. But we're still going. We're still kicking. And we managed to survive due to the generosity and decency and intelligence of a bunch of strangers who are united through the miracle of radio into a remarkable and fascinating community. Yes, we don't see each other. Nevertheless, we are all there. You're there. I'm here. Well, let us make a step towards union. Let us make a step to be united. 212-209-2950. Once I begin Orwell, we won't have time to interlard the idle chatter with a phone number, so you might want to write that phone number down now and call at your leisure, but call this morning and call before 8, please. Pretty please with mustard on it. I'm doing all I can to entice you to support WBAI, which, frankly, It's been a rough week. It's hard enough at times, but it's been a rough week. 212-209-2950. Nobody's calling. Hey, you know, Hey, that's because you don't expect me on at this time. Now, do you? Well, there you go. Surprise, right? Surprise. WBAI, New York. The phone number remains 212-209-2950. Do what you can, but do it now. It is now 7 o'clock, and you are listening to As I Please. And again, As I Please, the title of a column by George Orwell, and the principle that underlies that title is simple. I bring to your attention things that I love, things that I admire, and I do it to please you. And perhaps you have heard something on As I Please that has sparked your interest. Perhaps this was the first occasion where you heard of the great American poet George Oppen. Perhaps here's where we have refreshed your memory of the glories of Dante or Homer. And the way things are looking right now, the next summer series will be the final summer series with Dante, as I threatened years ago. However, I can be easily persuaded to change my mind in that rather drastic decision if, well, you act now. 212-209-2950. We begin with Ben Webster, and I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good. A beautiful tune, a Duke Ellington tune, that is wonderfully rendered by Ben Webster. And in the course of the summer series, I have been giving you treats from the Ellington Orchestra, a small combo group groups made up of members of the Ellington Orchestra. And I do hope that you've enjoyed that. You can't get that every day either. So maybe two things well worth crowing about. The glories of Shakespeare and the glories of Duke Ellington. And I've really become convinced that Ellington is, in jazz, the Shakespeare of jazz, because he did so much. 212-209-2950. Well, I guess it's time to batten down the hatches. If only there was a lock on this door. If only there was light in this studio. 212-209-2950. I can promise you that. And that not a cent that you donate to WBAI will go on anything trivial like light bulbs or working turntables. We make you that solemn vow. 212-209-2950. Let's take that again. As I try to find a place where there might actually be light. Tolstoy's pamphlets are the least known part of his work, and his attack on Shakespeare is not even an easy document to get hold of, at any rate in an English translation. Perhaps, therefore, it will be useful if I give a summary of the pamphlet before trying to discuss it. Tolstoy begins by saying that throughout life, Shakespeare has aroused in him, quote, an irresistible repulsion and tedium. Conscious that the opinion of the civilized world is against him, he has made one attempt after another on Shakespeare's works, reading and rereading them in Russian, English, and German. But I invariably underwent the same feelings, repulsion, weariness, and bewilderment. Now, at the age of 75, he has once again reread the entire works of Shakespeare, including the historical plays, and I have felt with even greater force the same feelings, this time, however, not of bewilderment, but of firm, indubitable conviction that the unquestionable glory of a great genius which Shakespeare enjoys and which compels writers of our time to imitate him and readers and spectators to discover in him non-existent merits, thereby distorting their aesthetic and ethical understandings, Shakespeare is a great evil, as is every untruth. Shakespeare, Tolstoy adds, is not merely no genius, but is not even an average author. And in order to demonstrate this fact, he will examine King Lear, which, as he is able to show by quotations from Hazlitt, Brandes, and others, has been extravagantly praised and can be taken as an example of Shakespeare's best work. Tolstoy then makes a sort of exposition of the plot of King Lear, finding it at every step to be stupid, verbose, unnatural, unintelligible, bombastic, vulgar, tedious, and full of incredible events, wild ravings, mirthless jokes, anachronisms, irrelevancies, obscenities, worn-out stage conventions, and other faults, both moral and aesthetic. And Lear is, in any case, a plagiarism of an earlier and much better play, King Lear, by an unknown author, which Shakespeare stole and then ruined. It is worth quoting a specimen paragraph to illustrate the manner in which Tolstoy goes to work. Act 3, Scene 2, in which Lear, Kent, and the Fool are together in the storm, is summarized thus. Lear walks about the heath and says words that are meant to express his despair. He desires that the wind should blow so hard that they, the winds, should crack their cheeks, and that the rain should flood everything, that lightning should singe his white head, and the thunder flatten the world and destroy all germs that make ungrateful man. The fool keeps uttering still more senseless words. Enter Kent. Lear says that for some reason during this storm all criminals should be found out and convicted. Kent, still unrecognized by Lear, endeavors to persuade him to take refuge in a hovel. At this point, the fool utters a prophecy in no wise related to the situation, and they all depart. Tolstoy's final verdict on Lear is that no unhypnotized observer, if such an observer existed, could read it to the end with any feeling except aversion and weariness. And exactly the same is true of all the other extolled dramas of Shakespeare, not to mention the senseless dramatized tales Pericles, Twelfth Night, The Tempest, Cymbeline, Troilus and Cressida. Having dealt with Lear, Tolstoy draws up a more general indictment against Shakespeare. He finds that Shakespeare has a certain technical skill, which is partly traceable to his having been an actor, but otherwise no merits whatever. He has no power of delineating character, or making words and actions spring naturally out of situations. His language is uniformly exaggerated and ridiculous. He constantly thrusts his own random thoughts into the mouth of any character who happens to be handy. He displays a complete absence of aesthetic feeling, and his words have nothing whatever in common with art and poetry. Shakespeare might have been whatever you like, Tolstoy concludes, but he was not an artist. Moreover, his opinions are not original or interesting, and his tendency is of the lowest and most immoral. But here, there arises a difficult question. If Shakespeare is all that Tolstoy has shown him to be, how did he ever come to be so generally admired? Evidently, the answer can only lie in a sort of mass hypnosis or epidemic suggestion. The whole civilized world has somehow been deluded into thinking Shakespeare a good writer. And even the plainest demonstration to the contrary makes no impression, because one is not dealing with a reasoned opinion, but with something akin to religious faith. Throughout history, says Tolstoy, there has been an endless series of these epidemic suggestions. For example, the Crusades, the search for the Philosopher's Stone, the craze for tulip growing, which once swept over Holland, and so on and so forth. As a contemporary instance, he cites, rather significantly, the Dreyfus case, over which the whole world grew violently excited for no sufficient reason. There are also sudden, short-lived crazes for new political and philosophical theories, or for this or that writer, artist, or scientist. For example, Darwin, who, in 1903, is beginning to be forgotten. And in some cases, a quite worthless popular idol may remain in favor for centuries, for it also happens that such crazes, having arisen in consequence of special reasons accidentally favoring their establishment, correspond in such a degree to the views of life spread in society, and especially in literary circles, that they are maintained for a long time. Shakespeare's plays have continued to be admired over a long period because they corresponded to the irreligious and immoral frame of mind of the upper classes of his time and ours. As to the manner in which Shakespeare's fame started, Tolstoy explains it as having been got up by German professors towards the end of the 18th century. His reputation originated in Germany and thence was transferred to England. The Germans chose to elevate Shakespeare because at a time when there was no German drama worth speaking about and French classical literature was beginning to seem frigid and artificial, they were captivated by Shakespeare's clever development of scenes and also found in him a good expression of their own attitude towards life. Goethe pronounced Shakespeare a great poet, whereupon all the other critics flocked after him like a troop of parrots, and the general infatuation has lasted ever since. The result has been a further debasement of the drama, and a further corruption of the prevailing moral outlook. It follows that the false glorification of Shakespeare is an important evil which Tolstoy feels it his duty to combat. One's first feeling is that in describing Shakespeare as a bad writer, he is saying something demonstrably untrue. But this is not the case. In reality, there is no kind of evidence or argument by which one can show that Shakespeare, or any other writer, is good. Nor is there any way of definitely proving that, for instance, Warwick Deeping is bad. Ultimately, there is no test of literary merit except survival, which itself is merely an index to majority opinion. Artistic theories such as Tolstoy's are quite worthless because they not only start out with arbitrary assumptions, but depend on vague terms, sincere,